Hello, and welcome to the Scriptures Are Real podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about things that help the Scriptures become more real to us so we can draw more power out of them because we need all the help we can get. I'm your host, Kerry Muehlstein, and I'm so excited to have with me Dr. Matt Godfrey, who is from the Joseph Smith Papers project. And just welcome, Matt. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Kerry. I'm really excited about this. Grateful to you for having me on.
Well, I'm glad you would make the time. I know everyone at the Joseph Smith Papers is very busy and doing all sorts of great stuff. So we're the entire church is grateful for what you guys do. So thank you for that.
Thanks.
So Matt has a PhD in American history from Washington State University. And he's written different books and articles and so on, obviously part of the publications project as well, or the Joe Smith project as well. But that's the boring stuff. Why don't you tell us about you, your family, or whatever else would help us kind of understand you and what makes you tick and why you like history or whatever else. You don't have to tell us that. You can tell us about water skiing if you want, whatever you want.
Oh, great. Well, I kind of have history in my blood. My father has a PhD in history. My mother had a master's degree in history. Both of them loved church history. They were active members of the Mormon History Association for a long, long time. My mom has since passed away. My father is in his 90s, so he doesn't attend meetings anymore, but he still loves reading history. So I was kind of always around history growing up. But to tell you the truth, I didn't have much interest in pursuing a career in history. I wanted to get a PhD in English and be an English professor. And that was kind of my initial career plan when I started attending BYU as an undergraduate. But as I kind of went along, I realized I didn't particularly enjoy literary criticism a whole lot. As I went into some of the upper division classes in the English major, and then I found out, too, since I was minoring in history, I found out that if I switched my major to history, I could graduate like a year and a half sooner. And so that kind of sealed the deal for me. And I said, OK, I'm going to switch it up. So decided to switch my major to history. And then the plan was to get a PhD in history and teach somewhere. But as I finished my master's degree, I got my master's degree at Utah State University, and I was looking at PhD programs to apply to, and discovered something called public history, which I hadn't ever really heard about before. And it was essentially how you present history to the general public and how you engage the public with history. And that kind of caught my eyes. So when I did my PhD, I actually had a dual major in American history and public history, in kind of being trained on how to present history to the public. So that became kind of something that I became passionate about. When I finished my PhD, I got hired by a historical consulting firm in Missoula, Montana, and worked there for about 8.5 years. And we did a lot of work supporting the federal government when they were getting sued over historical issues. So they'd have us do research reports on water rights or Native American resource issues, those types of things, and write expert witness reports for them. And that was really interesting. But I got the chance in 2010 to kind of switch careers and got hired on at the Joseph Smith Papers and started working on that project, and became the managing historian of the project in 2013 and continued in that role till 2021. Was also a general editor of the project beginning in 2015. And then I was the lead historian on several volumes in the document series and contributed to some other volumes as well. So that's kind of what I did on the Joseph Smith Papers. Aside from Joseph Smith and that era of church history, I love the history of sugar beets and the beet sugar industry in the Intermountain West. That's what my PhD dissertation was on. I published a book about that. And, I always just get excited talking about sugar beets. It has a very long history in Utah and Idaho, especially, that contributed much to the economies of those two states. So it was very important in the 20th century.
Probably then, that book's a real hit at Jordan High School because they're the beet diggers, right?
That's right.
Oh, good.
And then just kind of rounding out what I've been doing, we published our last volume of the Joseph Smith Papers in 2023. And so there are a few people that still work on the Joseph Smith Papers because there are some things being posted to the website still. But our hard copy print publications are finished. So I actually took on a different role in the church history department a couple of years ago, where I do more outreach and engagement with historical organizations and academics. So that's kind of more what I'm focused on right now. And I'm also excited. I have a book coming out June 17th from Deseret Book called God Knows You. It's about spiritual challenges that we face, that youth and YSAs face. Written for them, and I'm really happy about that book, so I'm excited to see that come out. So I'm married. I have four kids that are awesome. They range in ages from 26 to almost 16, and I love sports, and I love way too much 80s alternative music, so I listen to way too much of that.
Well, I don't know if that's possible, but anyway, good.
I don't think it is, but...
So that's this book. I'm really excited about it. It's a book that's much needed, and that will have just come out. So I imagine everyone can get that at like Deseret Bookstores or DeseretBook.com or Amazon or something along those lines, huh?
Yeah, that's right.
So tell us one more time what it's called.
It's called God Knows You, Getting Real About Spiritual Challenges.
Fantastic. Well, thank you. Thank you for that. And with all of your kind of drilling down in the different source material with the Joe Smith Papers, I think you've come to learn a lot about something that I know a bit about, but I know I would love to know more about. And I think most members of the church really don't know much about, but it's an important element of church history during the time period we're studying right now. It's, and in fact, without it, we wouldn't be reading anything we're reading. So we'll kind of launch, and this is kind of a special episode because we're going to launch into this subject from Section 70, which is in this week's Come Follow Me reading. But it's a subject that spans several readings, and we don't want to chop it up. Let's just get to understand this subject. So we'll span several readings now, starting with what we're reading this week, and it's going to span several. But why don't you take us in where you'd like to go?
Yeah. So we're going to talk today a little bit about the United Firm and what that was and how it operated in the church, when it operated, how it formed, and those types of things. And the United Firm, it's a very interesting thing. I think most church members do not know what the United Firm is.
Yeah, and I want to make it clear, we're not talking about the United Order. This is a different thing.
Right, exactly. And that's where some confusion comes in, because in the sections in the Doctrine and Covenants that talk about the United Firm, when those sections were published, they changed the word firm to order. And so you'll read United Order in like Section 78 or Section 82 or 104, but it's really referring to what the saints at that time knew as the United Firm, which was a very specific organization.
Very good. And just so you know, I've kind of been, as we've been approaching this, I've kind of been priming our audience a little bit when we've had chances to talk about W.W. Phillips going down to Missouri and Sidney Gilbert going, and how he's supposed to help provide an economic engine there, while you've got Newell Whitney being an economic engine in Ohio. And I've kind of primed our audience, so I'm telling you, but I'm also reminding my audience to think back to this, where we've said you're going to need to know these things in the future as we try and understand some things that are happening. So hopefully we're primed a little bit, but we're ready to understand some new things.
All right. Well, really, you know, kind of what you were talking about there, the genesis of the United Firm extends all the way back into what we have as Section 57 in the Doctrine and Covenants, that section where the saints are commanded to build the city of Zion in Jackson County, Missouri. Because that section, like you mentioned, it directs William W. Phelps to move to Missouri to establish a printing office in Missouri. It tells Sidney Gilbert that he's supposed to operate a storehouse in Jackson County as well. So you have kind of these two, you know, a publishing endeavor, a mercantile endeavor that the saints are supposed to set up in Jackson County. And again, this is July 1831 that this is being commanded. Edward Partridge, who's the bishop in the church, is also told to move to Missouri, where he's going to act as the bishop there. And then a few months after Section 57 is given in December 1831, Newell K. Whitney is directed by the Lord, is appointed by the Lord to be another bishop in the church, responsible for temporal affairs of the church in Kirtland, Ohio. So you have, you know, Bishop Partridge, Sidney Gilbert, Bishop Whitney responsible for kind of the temporal affairs of the church for this storehouse in Missouri, as well as Newell K. Whitney's storehouse that he already had in Kirtland, Ohio. Now, at the same time, and this is where Section 70 comes in. So in early November, the church holds a series of conferences that are all kind of geared around the publication of Joseph Smith's revelations. So prior to this time, when Joseph Smith would receive a revelation, he would dictate it, a scribe would write it down. Perhaps if it was given on behalf of someone, that person might make a copy of that revelation that they could have. And then John Whitmer, beginning in 1831, was directed to buy a record book. And then when Joseph Smith had a revelation, Whitmer would copy that revelation into this record book. And that record book becomes known as the Book of Commandments and Revelations. We call it in the Joseph Smith papers, we published it in Revelations and Translations, Volume 1, and called it the Manuscript Revelation Book. Manuscript Revelation Book 1, I think, is what we call it. That's a real, real catchy name that we came up with there. So that's pretty much how the church had records of Joseph Smith's revelations. They had personal copies that were made, and then they had these official copies that were in this Manuscript Revelation Book. Well, they decide that as the church is growing, as more people are being sent out to preach the gospel, to perform missionary work, they need to have a way to better or to get people more familiar with Joseph Smith's revelations, and a better way is that for missionaries to take those revelations out so that they can tell people about them. They can reference the revelations, they can read from them, whatever else. And so there's a series of meetings that are held in November of 1831 about publishing Joseph's revelations in a book that they titled the Book of Commandments. That was to be this first compilation of revelations. And as they're talking about how to publish the revelations, they know that they want William W. Phelps to publish. He's going to be the publisher of the revelations from the print shop in Missouri. But they also believe that there needs to be individuals other than just Phelps who prepare the revelations for publication, who kind of supervise the publication of the revelations, make sure that what is printed is accurate, that it reflects well what the revelation truly says, those types of things. So in a conference that's held November 12th, 1831, in which they make kind of this final decision to publish the revelations, they vote Joseph Smith's revelations to be greater than all the riches of the earth, more valuable than all the riches of the earth. They decide too in this conference that they need to have people established to supervise the publication of the revelations. And Joseph then receives a revelation during this conference, and this is what Section 70 in the Doctrine and Covenants, that appoints six men to be what the revelation calls stewards over the revelations. And so that's Joseph Smith, Oliver Cowdery, Sidney Rigdon, John Whitmer, William W. Phelps, and Martin Harris. Those are the six men who are appointed stewards over the revelations.
And just for our audience, you can see those names in Section 70, verse 1. So if you don't remember, that's where you'll find them. And we always hope that you're reading this, the sections were a supplement, not a substitute for the sections. So anyway, sorry, keep going.
Yeah. So these six men eventually will become known as the literary firm in the church. the six men who are kind of responsible for the church's printing endeavors, specifically for the publication of the Book of Commandments. And the Revelation also talks about, if you go to, let's see, just looking at this verse, starting with verse 5, it says, I've appointed unto them, meaning those six men, and this is their business in the church of God, to manage them, meaning the revelations, and the concerns thereof, yea, the benefits thereof. It says, wherefore, a commandment I give unto them, that they shall not give these things unto the church, neither unto the world. Nevertheless, inasmuch as they receive more than is needful for their necessities and their wants, it shall be given into my storehouse, and the benefit shall be consecrated unto the inhabitants of Zion. Now, the word benefits in there, in the earliest manuscript version that we have of this revelation, the word benefits actually is rendered as profits. And so what they're talking about in these verses is they're saying, as you publish the revelations, you'll make money from the publication of the revelations. That money is to be used to provide you and your family with necessary support, since it's, you know, one of your jobs in the church is to supervise this publication. And then whatever is left over from that will be, consecrated unto the inhabitants of Zion. It will be used for other endeavors in the church. And so these six individuals are not only responsible for the publication of the revelations, they're also responsible for the money that the church makes from those, and to see that it is put to the use for the building of Zion. So that's kind of what those verses there are talking about. So you have those six men that are set up as the stewards over the revelations. You have Sidney Gilbert and Newell K. Whitney, another two men who are over the mercantile endeavors of the church, those two storehouses in Missouri and in Kirtland. And then you have Edward Partridge, who is the bishop of the church in Missouri, is also responsible for the church's temporal affairs. So kind of these nine men who are overseeing either publication endeavors or business endeavors for the church. And again, they're all in place doing these things by the end of 1831 and kind of acting in these roles. So just keep going from there.
Yeah. I think so. Maybe we could take just a second. We don't need to spend a long time, but I love this idea when we get it maybe said so well in verse 3. When after he said who, he says, I've appointed them and ordained them to be stewards over the revelations and commandments. Now, when we hear stewardship, we usually think, okay, either we think like consecration and united order kind of things, or we think, okay, this is someone who can receive inspiration for someone else. And both of those revolve around what being a steward really is, which is that things belong to the Lord, and he's asking you to take care of them. It's almost like the parable of the talents, right? I'm going to give you, these are mine, I'm giving these to you, and I want you to do something with them that builds up the kingdom. And it's so interesting to have people to be stewards over the revelations and commandments. You would expect Joseph Smith would be, you get John Whitmer as the church historian and so on, but it makes me wonder, so this helps us understand what's going on there, but to make this a little bit more of a personal application, I wonder how good of a steward I am over the revelations and commandments I'm given, right? And this goes back to that, like, okay, I can receive inspiration for myself and my family and people, and within my calling and so on. And I get lots of inspirations, and I know that often I am not a good steward over those revelations. Like I'll be praying in the morning. I've finally learned to keep a little book next to where I say my prayers so I can write ideas down. But half the time I'm so tired, I don't remember to do that and whatever. I know that I can be a better steward over the revelations. And I suspect that God is going to ask me about it, just like he's says in verse 4, an account of this stewardship will I require of them in the day of judgment, right? He's giving them real, very, very important revelations that are applicable for the whole world, much less, I mean, the church, but even the world. He's asking them, take care of these revelations, do magnify these revelations. And I'm going to ask you what you did with it, just like that parable of the talents. Okay, did you bury it or did you do something with it? And I suspect he's going to ask me, and I may have a few things to answer for at that point. So anyway, that's just a little bit off topic of the main historical thrust, but related to it enough that, as I think about how this might apply to us, besides the fact that we should be stewards over these same revelations, right? These people have gone through a lot of work to make it so you and I can read this, and I hope we're taking it seriously. My sense is that Come Follow Me is helping us take it more seriously than we ever have, but I hope we continue to take it seriously.
I love that idea of being a steward over the revelations that God gives to you. I don't think I've ever thought of it quite in that way. And I'm kind of the same way. Throughout most of my life, I never really would write down anything that I felt was inspiration. And finally, President Eyring talked about in 2007, oh, remember, where he talked about how he would write down at the end of every day how he had seen God's hand in his life. And I've tried thereafter to be a little more diligent with recording some of that inspiration, but I still don't do a very good job of it. And I think a lot of times I forget, some of the inspiration that I've had or some of the spiritual experiences that I've had. So I love that reminder that we need to be good stewards over revelations that God's given us.
Yeah. I fail in two ways. I fail both in terms of, this happened in my life and I don't write it down. Right. I'm thinking right now of something that happened just last night where my wife and I were praying for something and an idea came and, oh, that worked. Hopefully I can remember that by Sunday, but probably not. I've forgotten it. But I also get inspiration for things I should do. Right. And then later on in the day, I was like, wait, what was that I was supposed to do? And that's why I have to have a little book by my bed, because I don't remember to do all the ideas that come to me. So, yeah, there are lots of ways we can be stewards of revelations, including the revelations we're talking about. So thanks for letting us talk about that. But yeah, let's keep pressing forward so we can understand how this works in church history.
Yeah, I think, too, just to point out something about the role that these stewards had over the revelations, because I think it touches on something that sometimes people can sometimes have an issue with. So we tend to think sometimes that the Lord gave a revelation to Joseph Smith and he wrote it down and that revelation should never be changed because it comes from God. Mm-hmm. Well, what happens with these six men, and especially Joseph Smith, Oliver Cowdery, Sidney Rigdon, and John Whitmer, those four especially, they go over these manuscript revelations, these copies of the revelations in the book that John Whitmer has been keeping. And you can see when you go into that book that as they're preparing these revelations for publication, they are making some changes. They're making punctuation changes, which is understandable. But there are some instances where they're making wording changes. And for the saints at the time, that wasn't anything remarkable. In fact, in the November 12th meeting that I was telling you about, in the minutes of that meeting, it talks about how that conference pretty much told Joseph Smith, you need to go back through these and make sure that they really say what the Lord needs us to hear. And so I think Joseph and Sidney and Oliver and John believe that they could go back through these. And perhaps when they were first recorded, it wasn't quite exactly right. And so maybe there needed to be some changes so that these revelations communicated to the saints, exactly what the Lord wanted them to hear. And so I think that that's an important principle, that Joseph Smith believed that these were living revelations. He did not believe that when the revelation was given to him, it had to be, stay that exact same way forever. But he believed that he could go back through these with inspiration from God. And if God told him that he needed to correct something, that was fine for him to correct it.
I think that is a really important point. And sometimes you're absolutely right. We struggle with that in so many ways. I just don't know that I fully understand why. I think sometimes we feel like Joseph Smith was like a a Xerox machine for God or something like that, that God gives it to him in this perfect language. But Joseph Smith himself, like Moroni or Mormon, often talked about, or the ether, the how difficult it is to convey the ideas that he gets from God in words. And he talks about like being in the prison of a broken, crooked, and scattered language, right? He has these ideas coming to him, and we can probably all relate to this. I've had ideas come to me where, like, I understand that, and when I try and tell it to someone else, I can't convey what the thought that came to me, the truth that came to me. I just can't figure out how to convey it. And I think that happens to Joseph Smith, and over time he realizes, okay, people are not understanding this the right way, and I should change it, or maybe the circumstances have changed and so on. I think we want to believe in modern prophecy, meaning God will continue to reveal and help us understand past revelations, and yet somehow it bothers us when it happens. But we should rejoice in the fact that God continues to guide prophets to help us understand better and better both new things and things that have already been said.
Yeah. Very important thing, I think.
Yeah. So thank you.
Yeah. So kind of the next thing that happens in this development of the United Firm comes on March 1st, 1832. And this is in another revelation that is given to Joseph Smith. This is given in kind of a council of high priests that is held in Kirtland on that day. And in this revelation, the Lord tells Joseph that the time has come to coordinate the management of the publications and the management of these storehouses. So there needs to be more coordination. There needs to be an administrative body set up to manage both of these concerns. And so in section 78, the Lord tells Joseph, verse 3, "For verily I say unto you, the time has come and is now at hand. And behold, and lo, it must needs be that there be an organization of my people in regulating and establishing the affairs of the storehouse for the poor of my people, both in this place and in the land of Zion." Now, that's how the verse reads in our, 2013 edition of the Doctrine and Covenants. But the original revelation, when it was first written down, when it said the affairs of the storehouse for the poor, that wasn't in there. Essentially, what the Lord said is that there needs to be an organization of my people in organizing the mercantile and publishing endeavors in my church. And so, again, that's why sometimes we get confused about the United Firm and about how it operated and what it was, because this language in this revelation was changed from its original purpose there. And we can talk I don't know if you want to talk now or if you want to talk later about why those changes were made.
Yeah, why not? I mean, I'll throw out what you're the expert, so I'm going to throw out what I would guess is at least one of the ideas, and then you can chew me down. But I would guess at least one of the ideas is that when the United Firm is dissolved, that as if you're going to publish this, you say, well, that's not really very applicable to people anymore. Let's change this to something that's more broadly applicable.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely one of the reasons. I think that there's also kind of a practical reason behind it, too. As we'll see, and when we go to section 82 in the Doctrine and Covenants, the people who were set up as members of the United Firm actually had to bind themselves together legally,
right,
so that each one of them was responsible for the firm's debts. And we'll see that one of the reasons why the United Firm was dissolved, and in fact, the major reason, was because it had gotten far into debt and it didn't have a clear way to repay those debts because of the expulsion of the saints from Jackson County, Missouri, which had destroyed the printing establishment there as well as the storehouse there. And yet the saints were still responsible for paying for the goods and for the printing equipment that were there. And they had no way to get the money to be able to do that. And so when the United Firm is dissolved, Joseph Smith, I think, does not want creditors to come after every member of the firm.
Right.
And so I think he puts in some of this more general language of what the firm was supposed to do in order to prevent creditors from coming after like Martin Harris or Oliver Cowdery or Sidney Rigdon. I think Joseph believed at the time that he and Newell Kate Whitney would be the two that would handle trying to pay off these debts. And so I think it was a way for him to try to free some of these other individuals from responsibility, by kind of making it a little more vague about what the firm was doing.
Wonderful. Yeah. And what an important thing. Sometimes we forget about the practicalities of the restoration and of trying to do things in the midst of poverty and persecution. Right. And correct me if I'm wrong, which happens often, but I also have somewhere in the back of my mind that at one point, you know, you've got kind of the Ohio group and you've got the Missouri group, which is just true of the church in general at that point, but including with the United Firm and the literary firm. And it seemed also wise to decouple those so that if people go after the debt of what's going on in Missouri, that they don't necessarily have legal recourse on everything that's happening in Ohio and vice versa. Does that seem correct?
I think that's a correct reading of that situation. I think that's why you see in section 104, which is the section that kind of deals with the dissolution of the United Firm. It talks about kind of this dividing up of the firm into United Firm in Missouri, United Firm in Kirtland. And that section makes it seem like those two entities are going to continue to exist, but in reality, they didn't really exist after that point. But I think that kind of goes along with the point that you're making, that they're trying to divorce those two, different literary and mercantile endeavors in Missouri from those in Ohio.
Yeah. So sorry if I jumped ahead where we weren't ready to go yet, but
no, that's great. That's great.
Yeah. And that's the thing is that these are noble endeavors that are hard to pull off given great circumstances, but incredibly difficult to pull off when you are doing it from two different points far apart from each other, and both of them are experiencing different kinds of persecution at the same time. This is really difficult, but I am so grateful for what they did pull off because we're blessed by it today. So,
And you kind of add to that the issues with communication too, because it took a letter, from Kirtland to Jackson County about 3 weeks to get there. And, they don't have telephones. They can't just call somebody up and talk to them about things. And so you have Joseph sending letters to Missouri, you have Missouri leaders sending letters to Joseph. Sometimes they're crossing in the mail.
Yeah.
And I just think about just the practicality of trying to communicate everything that's going on as well. And it was difficult for sure.
Yeah. And trying to communicate or trying to get something that's printed in Missouri into the hands of people in Ohio, right? I mean, none of this is easy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, wonderful. Let's keep going.
Okay. So section 78 tells Joseph that he needs to organize this firm to oversee these publishing and mercantile endeavors in Missouri and in Ohio. And so the revelation also said that Joseph and Sidney Rigdon and Newell K. Whitney were supposed to travel to Missouri to set up this organization. So this revelation is given on March 1st, 1832, and Joseph and Sidney and Newell leave around April 1st, 1832 to go to Missouri. And if you're familiar at all with the history, one of the interesting things about this is that when Joseph and Sidney and Newell leave for Missouri, this is only, it may not even be a week since the attack on Joseph and Sidney in Hiram, Ohio, where Joseph's tarred and feathered, Sidney's, you know, head. He's probably concussed because of being dragged across the frozen ground. And Joseph's son, Joseph Murdoch, who was only about 11 months old at the time, dies in part because of being exposed to cold air where when he already had the measles. It kind of worsened his condition and he passes away. And so when these three men go to Missouri to fulfill this commandment in Section 78, it's not an ideal time. It's actually a very chaotic time for them to be going to do this. But they do it because they believe the Lord had commanded them to do it and that they needed to obey that commandment. I think it's a real testament of their willingness to obey even in difficult circumstances.
Well said. Well said. Yeah. These noble endeavors were never easy for them, but really starting from this time forward, it's really, really, really difficult both in Missouri and Ohio. Things are starting to get really tough.
Yeah, for sure. So they travel to Missouri. They get there about, you know, the third week in April or so of 1832. And they hold a conference, what they call a council of high priests there, in which Joseph sets up the United Firm. And he does so in accordance with both Section 78 as well as Section 82, which is a revelation that's received on April 26th, 1832. And this revelation comes in this council of high priests and elders that has been appointed, you know, for the purpose of organizing this firm. And so Section 82 lays out who are supposed to be the members of the United Firm. So if you go to verse 11 in Section 82, it lays out very clearly the members of the firm. Edward Partridge, Newell K. Whitney. Again, Edward Partridge is the bishop. Newell K. Whitney is a bishop as well as oversees the storehouse. A. Sidney Gilbert, who's over the storehouse in Missouri. Sidney Rigdon, one of the stewards of the revelations. Joseph Smith, another steward of the revelation. John Whitmer, Oliver Cowdery, W.W. Phelps, and Martin Harris, the rest of the stewards over the revelations. They're the nine men that are appointed to this firm. And verse 11 says, and this is what I was mentioning before, that they were supposed to be bound together by a bond and covenant that cannot be broken by transgression, except judgment shall immediately follow in your several stewardships. And after this revelation is given, they do draft a legal bond that binds each member together legally to be responsible for the firm's debts. And they do this in accordance with verse 11 here. Verse 12 in Section 82, again, it has that same vague language of Section 78 that the firm is supposed to manage the affairs of the poor and all things pertaining to the bishopric. Again, that language is changed from the more specific that it's supposed to manage the literary and mercantile endeavors of the church and all things pertaining to the bishopric, both in the land of Zion and in the land of Kirtland. So this is where the United Firm is established. So it consists of the literary firm, those six men over the revelations, the two bishops in the church, and Sidney Gilbert, who's over the storehouse of the church. So it's officially established here in April of 1832. It will continue to operate and administer those things in the church until roughly April 1834, which is when Section 104 is revealed that dissolves the United Firm. So we have it set up at that time. Now later, there are two other men who are added to the firm, and both of them are added by revelation. So one is Frederick G. Williams, who in January of 1833 is appointed one of the counselors to Joseph in the presidency of the high priesthood. Frederick also had extensive land holdings in Ohio at the time, so he had a land base that could be used to help finance some of the publications of the church. And he'll actually set up a company, F.G. Williams & Co., that is the company that will purchase a new printing press for the church after the one in Missouri is damaged in the mob attack there in July of 1833. And so he does kind of oversee some of the literary endeavors there. The other man who's added to the firm in 1833 as well is John Johnson, who also has extensive land holdings in Ohio. And so these two men, the Lord appoints them as members of the firm because they have resources that the firm can draw on to help manage the mercantile and publishing endeavors in the church. And so there ends up being 11 members of the United Firm in total.
Oh, fantastic. And just so my audience can keep following some of the stories we've been doing, John Johnson is the owner of this farm that Joseph and Emma have gone to stay at. It's where they're living when the tar and feathering happens. And he ends up being asked to consecrate the farm, really. And he sells it, moves to Kirtland. He's not able to access the funds for himself for a little while. He ends up being listed on the poor list. I don't know exactly what that is, but there's a list of poor that need to be helped and taken care of. And he's on there. And eventually he's going to be asked to run that inn, but he's also asked to help finance the purchase of lands and the printing. And so this is a family, John Johnson, and I've just forgotten the name of his wife.
Elsa.
Yeah. So John and Elsa, I don't know that we've told the story of how Elsa's arm is healed. It's one of the great healings early in the church. And Ezra Booth joins the church because he sees that, but then he's going to cause problems later and be partially responsible for that tarring and feathering. But John and Elsa are just consecrated individuals who give and give, first of all, and just taking people in on their home where significant things happen, and then in other ways, including in the way that we're looking at here.
Yeah, these people who are in the United Firm are really remarkable people. Yeah. I think, you know, I look at the Johnsons, Frederick G. Williams, Newell K. Whitney. I mean, here's a man who... Just a great man who I think was such a support to Joseph at the time, and stays a faithful member of the church his entire life. You know, there's others who will fall away and come back and whatever else, but Newell's true the whole time, and just a really, really great person, I think.
Yeah. And Edward Partridge, similarly, you're right. There are a lot of heroes to learn from in these, in this firm or these firms, people who, and I'll say that the longer I'm a member of the church, the more I realize the consecration is, at least for me, my great task. Like, it's something I want to be more and more consecrated, and it's hard to get more and more consecrated. Like, it's a good but painful process, I think, for any of us. And I am inspired by all of these people as I see the way they, and when I say consecrated, I don't mean just financially. I mean, I've talked about them giving up the farm and so on, but they're giving up the farm because they're consecrated in their hearts. And that's why they'll spend the time as well and so on. That's part of why these stories to me, and that's why we talk about the scriptures being real. This is very real. These are the real lives of these people that are behind and affected by these revelations. And when I see their lives, it inspires me and gives me motivation to continue forward in my own journey of consecration.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. There's so much to learn about that from these individuals and their families and just the sacrifices that they made here in the early church.
Yeah, I mean, really, when you say these names, if I were to think of some of my... I mean, of course, Joseph Smith is a huge hero in church history. But when I think of heroes in church history, Edward Partridge, Newell Whitney, Sidney Gilbert, and John and Elsa Johnson and Emma Smith and so on. But I just right at the top of the list of people that John Murdoch is another one for me. But I watch these guys and I think I am not currently at the point where I could do what they are doing, but I want to get there.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I would even add, you know, sometimes with like Sidney Rigdon and John Whitmer and Oliver Cowdery, because they don't stay in the church and they, you know, later on fall away. And I think sometimes we tend with those individuals to kind of shove them aside and say, well, you know, they didn't end up faithful. But at the time that they were in the church, they were so dedicated to the gospel, and they made a lot of sacrifices, as did their families, for the gospel when they were in it too.
I'd agree. And Martin Harris is another one who I mean, he does come back to the church. Actually, I learned a lot from Martin Harris. We've talked about him a number of times, you know, that the first lands being purchased in Missouri are from him, the financing of the Book of Mormon. There's a guy to learn from as well.
Yeah. Yep. Well, with the United Firm set up, let's talk just a minute about how it theoretically was supposed to operate. So William W. Phelps is printing the Book of Commandments in Missouri. He's also printing the church's newspaper there, the Evening and the Morning Star. The idea, again, I mentioned this before, the idea was that when these books are printed, they could be sold to people. And so there would be money coming in to the printing establishment from the sale of the books. At the same time, the two storehouses in the church, the one in Independence and the one in Kirtland, these were supposed to be operated for two different reasons. One was as a storehouse for the church, so as a place where the poor and the needy could come and could get necessary food and other supplies, you know, without charge if they were in need. But at the same time, both of these storehouses operated as for-profit stores as well. And so people could come in and could purchase goods as well, so they could be generating money. So the idea was that the money that the storehouses made from the sale of goods could be put into the printing of the Revelations and the printing of the newspaper. The proceeds from selling the Book of Commandments could be put into buying more goods to help stock the stores in Independence and Kirtland. And so there was kind of this symbiotic relationship that the United Firm tried to set up so that both the literary establishment and the mercantile establishments in the church could help finance each other. Yeah. So that was kind of the theory.
Lives of saints in different ways.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, because the other thing, too, is I think they believed that there would be enough money after that they could perhaps draw on some of that money, too, to continue to purchase land in Jackson County for inheritances there or to use it in other ways to benefit the poor and the needy in the church.
Yeah, beautiful. So that's why I was speaking about like the two stores as economic engines. That's the idea, I think, is that they will create what is needed to make the practicalities of Zion possible. And I my impression is that I think that the ashery that Newell Whitney owns also was generating money to be part of this. I don't know that for sure, but that's my impression. So
yeah, Newell had several different business endeavors that were all under his company that was called NK Whitney & Co. And actually, in the minutes of the meeting where the United Firm is set up, it talks about how there would be two divisions. One would be N.K. Whitney and Company in Ohio, and the other would be Gilbert Whitney and Company in Missouri.
Yeah.
Because maybe you talked about this before, but Sidney Gilbert and Newell K. Whitney were actually originally partners in Kirtland in kind of the mercantile field.
Yeah. And Sidney Gilbert only goes to Missouri because he's told to. To go and start a store there. Yeah. So they don't really like break up, but they divide and conquer, as it were. But and again, you just have they and Edward Partridge, who is a prosperous hatter, and they were on a trajectory to do very well in life, and they end up with a lot of church debt. Yep. That's what they end up with. So it's a tough road that they hoe.
Yeah. And I love too, Edward Partridge, you know, you mentioned before, and just one other thing with him, he and his family sacrificed so much, like you just talked about, in terms of worldly things, And Edward was such a humble person as well. You know, he's chastised a couple of times in the scriptures. Section 58 is one where he's chastised. And I love that after that revelation is given, there's a letter that we have that he writes to his wife, Lydia, because Edward's already in Missouri. Lydia's still in Ohio. The family hasn't moved to Missouri yet. And so Edward writes a letter to her. And he says in that letter something to the effect of, I fear that my calling is above my station. Yeah. You know, essentially, I don't know if I can do this. Like, I'm trying my best and I hope I can, but I don't know if I can. And that just kind of shows his humility that he had, that he knew he had to rely on the Lord to do this. And he was kind of a meek and humble person. And again, another one of my heroes for that.
Amen. Yeah. Amen.
So this is how the United Firm was supposed to work. And maybe if circumstances had turned out differently in Jackson County, maybe it would have continued for a lot longer in the church, kind of operating in this way. But of course, things don't go well in Jackson County. In this July of 1833, there are mobs that come up and decide on one day that they're going to attack the printing shop where the church is printing the Book of Commandments. And they also tar and feather Edward Partridge and Charles Allen at the same time because they don't want the saints there. They want the saints to leave. And the violence is kind of quelled because church leaders promise that they'll remove themselves from Missouri. It springs up again in the fall of 1833 after the church decides to explore legal options of how they can stay on their land in Jackson County. And people in Jackson County who aren't members of the church hear about this and they get angry again. And so there's more violence that last week of October, first week of November, that eventually ends up in all of the saints in Jackson County being kicked out of the county. And so when this happens, you have the printing shop has been destroyed. The printing press is damaged severely to where the church can't use it anymore. Sidney Gilbert loses the storehouse as well as all of the goods that are in the storehouse. And again, as I mentioned before, the church is still responsible for the debt that it went into to purchase those goods for the storehouse and to purchase the printing press and other things in the printing office. But you have half of the United Firm that's now been cut off that the church can't use to generate any kind of profit or any kind of income at all. And so that leads to a condition, an economic condition in the church that's really fairly unstable for a period of time. And by January of 1834, Joseph and the rest of the members of the United Firm are really concerned about how they're going to repay the debts that the United Firm has. And they meet together and they pray and they ask God to provide some way that they can get out of debt and pay off their pay off those to whom they are in debt to. And so they try to explore options of doing various things to try to pay off these debts. But by April of 1834, it's clear that they don't have the money to repay what they need to at the time. I think Newell K. Whitney in April kind of looks at his financial accounts. Again, he's the one that's purchased most of the goods for his store. And he says in there, you know, looking at all of these debts that I have and when I have to make payments on them, I need $8,000 pretty much immediately in order to be able to repay these debts. And that may not sound like a huge amount of money to us today, but in 1834, it was a considerable sum of money that they were going to have to come up with. The other thing that Newell does at the time, which again, I think just shows what a remarkable person he was. So the members of the United Firm who were in Ohio would often come to his store and they would get goods, food, other supplies for their family from his store. And they do it, you know, they would have an account. And so Newell would record what they took, how much they owed for it. And this is typical at the time, you know, Kirtland especially is a very cash poor society at the time. So you don't have people like we have today. They're not going to go in and pay money and get what they want. Most of the time they're getting goods. They're promising to pay later, or they're promising to pay in terms of like labor or in terms of a good, you know, an exchange of goods or some other way of repaying those debts.
It's especially common in an agrarian based society because you have such cycles of needing money and then bringing money in. So it's very common.
Yeah. And so the members of the United Firm had generated around, I think, $3,600 in debts in Newell K. Whitney's store. And because of the financial problems that the firm was having at the time and that the members of the firm were having, Newell forgave those debts. He essentially told them, you don't have to repay these to me, which was a big relief to those individual members. But it was a considerable financial loss to Newell, but one that he was willing to take on because he understood kind of the larger picture behind this. So I think that was really remarkable.
Yeah. Joseph Smith was one of those that he forgave debts to on the same day that he took on added debt for himself. So, yeah.
So you have these debts that are mounting. And remember, too, that by April of 1834, Joseph has been commanded to recruit people and to lead an expedition of people from Ohio to Missouri to help the saints there. That becomes known as the Zion's Camp Expedition, which I'm sure you'll talk about in future episodes. But Joseph, because of all of these debts, the United Firm, he doesn't really know if he's going to be able to go on this expedition because he's concerned that, you know, his creditors might come after him. There might be other circumstances. He doesn't really know what he's going to do. And so all of these factors lead into a revelation that comes to Joseph Smith in April of 1834, April 23rd, and which is section 104 of the Doctrine and Covenants. And it, as I've talked about before, it essentially dissolves the United Firm. And what it does is it takes the assets of the firm and it gives those assets to different members of the firm as their stewardship. So, for example, Newell K. Whitney's Ashery goes to somebody. I think it goes to Sidney Rigdon, maybe. Or no, actually, Sidney Rigdon gets the tannery, I think, in Kirtland to operate as his stewardship. And there's different other things that are operated by different members of the United Firm for their stewardship. And I think the reason for doing this again is I think Joseph Smith and others believed, and the Lord believed, that it would be easier to repay the debts if it was just on this individual basis rather than everybody being responsible for all of the United Firm's debts. Yeah. And in practicality, again, it's really Joseph Smith and Newell K. Whitney that take on the responsibility for the, you know, large amount of debt that the firm is in. They work hard. Newell works hard to repay debts. We have an account book that he has that I think is held at BYU from 1834, where it records how much money he's paying to different people. They're relying a lot on donations from other church members to try to help repay these debts. Some of them linger over, you know, into Joseph Smith's financial accounts well into 1837 and 1838. And when he has to leave Kirtland in 1838, he appoints Oliver Granger and others to try to continue to pay off these debts, which I really think is remarkable, because sometimes I think Joseph, by, you know, critics of the church will look at Joseph and they'll say, you know, oh, he didn't care about personal responsibility or anything. He didn't care if he repaid these debts or not. And that is just not what the historical record bears out. You see Joseph up to the end of his life trying to repay a lot of these debts and employing people to take on the responsibility of trying to figure out how to get these debts paid. I don't think there's ever a moment where Joseph says, nope, I don't feel like I'm responsible for anything. I think he's always, this is always weighing on him, trying to repay these things.
Yeah, I agree. And then it ends up affecting Emma as well. And I mean, it's a,
yes,
it's a bigger role in the practicalities of the church than we often think through. Again, John Johnson, I think, is one of those who some of the sale of his farm helps to pay down debt. And I think it also helps finance science camp and so on. But anyway, just all these individuals that are giving and giving.
Yeah. Yeah. So after April of 1834, the United Firm really ceases to exist. When you read the Revelation again, it makes it sound as though the firm will continue, that it's just being reorganized. But in essence, what happens is that after April of 1834, it's really kind of the Kirtland High Council, which has just been formed in February of 1834, that takes on a lot of the, you know, administrative responsibility of the church in Ohio. And then there's another high council that's formed in Missouri in July of 1834 that takes on that same role in Missouri. So you see these high councils kind of taking on the role that the United Firm had.
Yeah. And eventually they kind of coalesce in the Far West High Council.
Yes. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Now, the literary
that's an important
firm
part
does
of the development of the church, if it's all right, just to say that we see during this period in both Missouri and Ohio, the continuing development of the organization of the church. And we're going to talk about that in other episodes because it's a part of, I mean, Revelation's about calling the corner 12 and so on and so on. But the high council of these stakes, right, and the stakes, like, the way it ends up being described in Missouri is that the stake president, and that's one of the Whitmers, if I remember right, he's called the president of the church in Missouri, right? But that's the way we would say it is the Missouri stake. It's still kind of developing, but the high council will start to take on an increasingly important role when it's formed, so that then the high council becomes, first of all, the high council for Ohio and then Far West. And like you said, there's one before Far West in Missouri, and then the high council in Nauvoo. These become some of the most important governing bodies in the church at the time. And you're right, it starts to some of the other little things that, well, again, as we see development, I'll use an analogy. We have, to begin with, a first and second elder of the church. That's Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery. And eventually you're going to get a first presidency created and a first presidency and a quorum of the 12. And then a first presidency, you got first presidency, quorum of the 12, and these high councils. These firms seem to be kind of like the first and second elder, right? Okay, this is what we are going to put in place while you are developing so that then I can get something else in place that is more what we're familiar with, but it's all part of God leading them along line by line, step by step, and helping them get from where they start to where they need to be.
Yeah, I think that's a great analogy, especially because in the 2 years the United Firm existed, it really did play kind of a larger administrative role. So you see, when Joseph Smith wants information from leaders in Missouri about the church in Missouri, he's writing to the members of the United Firm who are living in Missouri to get that information. And so it really does play kind of this, you know, maybe temporary administrative role in the church until there are things put into place that perhaps make a little more sense in terms of governing the church in different locations.
Yeah. Now, you were saying something else when I started talking about that. What were you saying?
Yeah, I was just going to say that even though the United Firm ceases to exist, the literary firm does continue to exist for a couple of years after 1834, and it continues to kind of supervise church publications in Kirtland, because after the destruction of the printing office in Independence, they decide to set up a new printing office in Kirtland. And so that's set up, as I mentioned, it's operated by F.G. Williams and Co. Oliver Cowdery kind of becomes the editor of the church's newspaper, which is called the Messenger and Advocate at that time. This is where the 1835 edition of the Doctrine and Covenants is published. And so that literary firm does continue to exist. I think we have reference of it in 1835, and I think maybe even in 1836, there might be one reference to it. So that portion does kind of continue to exist to oversee the publication endeavors in the church.
Yeah, and I think we don't recognize how indebted we are to what they were able to do, even though the press is destroyed partway through and so on. I mean, the two newspapers, the amount of information that we have, historical and doctrinal, from the what's printed in the newspapers, the beginning of the publication of the Book of Commandments, there are things that are important to us historically and doctrinally that we would be bereft of without that literary firm taking seriously its stewardship over the revelations.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. Yeah. It's wonderful to see how that commandment that's given in November of 1831 in section 70, you know, these stewards continue to take it very seriously. And there's other stewards that are added to those. I think David Whitmer is another one who kind of helps oversee some of these things. But yeah, that's one thing that I think is important to consider, that when we read the Revelations and the Doctrine and Covenants, they have, you know, meaning to us and they have application to us. But at the time that these revelations were given, they had very specific meanings to church members at the time. And these church members viewed these as commandments, as, you know, covenants with God, that they would do certain things. And they took it very seriously to do those things and to try to fulfill those commandments.
Yeah. And that, I mean, that's a blessing to everyone who was a member of the church at the time, but it continues to be a blessing to us now. Yeah. Again, just good motivation to be a good steward over whatever it is God is asking you to be a good steward over. You don't know where this ends up.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, thank you. That's again, I think we often have not understood very well both one of my goals for the podcast this year is to help everyone understand the kind of Ohio-Missouri era as not two separate eras, but two separate places in the same era and how they're working together and sometimes apart and together. And this is an important part of that. But I also hope we can get some of these behind the scenes things like the United Firm, the literary firm that we often haven't talked about, that we can bring those to light again in both cases, because that makes these scriptures very real to me. And then I can apply them to my life better. So I hope that everyone's experiencing that as we are talking and going through this together. Anything else you would like to add?
No, I think this has been great. Again, you know, the United Firm, if you want more information about it, you can read, there's a little essay that I wrote about Newell K. Whitney's role in it in the book Revelations in Context, which is in Gospel Library. And kind of goes over a lot of what I talked about today, if it's easier to read some of that, because it can be very confusing in trying to figure out what's going on. But again, you know, just highlighting how grateful I am for these individuals and their families who took on so much in these early years of the church and who sacrificed so much so that the church could continue. And could continue to grow in its infancy. Like you were saying, I think we owe them a large debt for what they did and what they endured.
Amen. So grateful to all of them and to the Lord for caring enough to ask them to do these things and caring enough about us to continue to give them to us and ask us to do things. So we are blessed. Well, thank you, Matt. We're so grateful, and I always am so grateful for the revelations we have. Glad to live in a day of modern restoration and latter-day prophecy and so on. I think we underestimate how blessed we are to live in a day where we have ongoing revelation. We also want to thank our audience, and we'll encourage you to it will help us reach more people if you like and share and download and rate and review and all those things. Share on social media, leave comments. Please do leave comments. But the biggest thing we'll ask you to do is if there was something that touched you, go do something about it and share it with someone in person. Those would be great blessings. And jump back into the scriptures. We'll post some bonus material on our Patreon website and some daily thoughts. So we'll invite everyone to be there. It's tsar.website. You can join us there. We just want to thank those who donate and make this possible through their DAFs and PayPal Giving Fund or however they do it. We keep doing this because a lot of people like Newell K. Whitney are generous and help us keep doing this. So we thank everyone for that, but especially today, thank you, Matt. We're grateful for you.
Thank you very much. Really enjoyed it and appreciate the opportunity.